Happy Healthy Tuesday, and welcome to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this week I am so excited to share with you my conversation with Caleb Nichols. Caleb is a local. He's also a poet, a musician, a songwriter, a singer, a librarian. Yes, a librarian. He has two master's degrees, and he's working to finish up his PhD in creative and critical writing. And I got a chance to meet Caleb backstage at Live Oak Music Festival, where he performed this summer. And what I loved about this conversation is that Caleb's one of those people that feels like an old friend from the first minute you meet him. There wasn't a lot of small talk or kind of dancing around, you know, the more easy subjects. He just dove right in. And we talked about his childhood and his interest in music and kind of his struggles going through school and then dealing with anxiety and all the different things that he had to do to cope with the changes in his career and keeping up with life as a poor musician. He just laid it out there, and I loved it every minute. And so I've been really looking forward to sharing this conversation with you, because Caleb has so many talents and things that he is working on at any one time. It could have been three different conversations, but I've tried to pull all of his talents together and share them with you today. He talks about his album that he recently released called Ramon, which is a nod to the Beatles, whom he loves, and his new book that he also released this year called Don't Panic, A Hitchhiker's Guide to Panicking, and his interest in writing and his work, the work he's doing to finish up his PhD in Wales. So we'll be doing things a little differently today. We won't be taking calls, but you can still be a part of the conversation by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can join us on Facebook or Instagram, The Reluctant Therapist, where you can post your thoughts or check out future shows or see my current guest. You can also listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org, the news talk tab. And you can podcast our show by visiting wherever it is you get your podcasts, search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and hit subscribe. And if you leave a review, other people can find the show as well, and we'd appreciate that. So we're going to talk to Caleb Nichols, and I'm glad you're here. And we're going to get started right away. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Rabbit wrote a manifesto stating reasons why he could not be bothered to be bothered.
I started playing music because I needed to express myself, and I just wanted to. Probably I started playing music because of the Beatles.
Really?
Yeah. And I...
And let's say, how old are you?
I was 22.
Did you? Wow.
I'm 22. I just turned 21. No, yeah. I'm 39.
That's a young person to say the Beatles got me to start playing music, don't you think?
Yes, but okay. I was the right age in like the second wave of Beatlemania, which was when the anthology came out in 1995.
Okay.
I was 11 and 12-ish around then.
Which is still young to discover the Beatles, I think.
I had a really good mom. I have a really good mom who took me to the public library in Los Osos and checked some Beatles CDs out for me. And I didn't know what they were or who they were, and we got Rubber Soul first.
Yeah.
And that was the one that just, it flipped a switch. Before that, I had been really creative, artistic. I was into drawing and stuff. But when I heard Rubber Soul, I just knew that's what I wanted to do.
And were you taking piano lessons?
My grandma taught me piano a little bit. And, like, you know, I was in school bands. I played trombone. I played trumpet. But nothing like hearing a guitar band and then knowing, like, this is it. And then, so my mom bought me a bass, and I started playing bass. That was how I started. And I learned, the first song I learned was Day Tripper.
Really?
And then...
That's not an easy song.
Well, you know, it's riff-based. So, okay. Bam, 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 bam. You know, it's very, like, you can pick out the notes. And so I taught myself and just started playing. And then I would, you know, use those little skills of how to play a note on bass and write my own songs from a very, like, right from the beginning. But mostly just mimicking things. Mm-hmm. So I was also, at the same time, it's mid-90s, really into alternative rock and Stone Temple Pilots, Smashing Pumpkins, things like that. So whatever was on MTV. And I was lucky enough to be in that really prime MTV time where music was just incredibly good.
Yeah.
And there were so many
bands.
And
easily accessible.
Yeah, and, you know, I had the BMG CD of the Month Club where you send a penny in,
yes,
and they send you 25 CDs, yes, and then they send your mom a bill for $80,000.
So true.
And then repeat that a few times.
Yes.
And the warehouse CD store and Boo Boos and things like that. But we were pretty poor, so the library CDs were a huge, huge thing for me, just having access to that.
Why? What was your mom's love of music? Why did she know to even get you started?
I think that the transition from elementary school to junior high was really rough for me,
mm-hmm,
and I think she knew that I needed something.
That's a good mom.
She's a good mom.
Why was it a rough transition?
Well, I'm a queer person, and I was the last to know it. And so, you know, I was 11 years old in seventh grade and was just bullied mercilessly. And it hurt. And I was really lonely all of a sudden, which was a shock because elementary school was great. I was the class clown. I had a lot of friends. I think everything just changed. And I was
puberty hits and everybody starts sectioning off.
Yes. And it really didn't hit me because I was a year younger than everybody.
Okay.
I went into school early because I have a late birthday. And, you know, that label got stuck to me and it never went away. And it was really tough. Los Osos Middle School in the 90s was a rough place. One of my best friends, Jameson Swanigan, who plays with me sometimes, he also went to Los Osos Middle School at the same time. We were in the same grade.
And were you friends back then?
We were kind of acquaintances. We never got there, but we became friends later. And, you know, we're both 39 now. I look back, if I had a child going through that, I would be really upset.
Mm-hmm.
If I knew anything about that, like the bullying and the violence that we saw at that school, the things that they sort of made us do, was not great.
And then did you go to Morro Bay High School or something?
I did, and I had a pretty rough run. I was a very, you know, I had a lot of depression and anxiety that was undiagnosed, and I was a queer person, and so.
When did you become aware of that?
I kind of got it, you know. I kind of knew, but I didn't really become very aware of it till 14, 15. But then I became very aware of that.
And did you embrace it? Was it like
I did. My coping strategy was, I remember actually really having this thought after freshman year going, okay, this isn't working for me trying to fit in. And I just kind of went the other way and I discovered punk and had a lot of friends that did that too. And found a new tribe of people and went to shows. Numbskull Presents was a big punk promoter here. Those were really helpful. And so school was rough for me, but socially I had my own thing going on. People might remember Garden Street in the 90s, Linnea's Cafe. So that was
absolutely
a scene that was like crucial to me having a life.
Were you playing in the coffee house?
Yeah, I started. So around then, middle of high school, I started playing little shows and writing songs. Very heavily like Tori Amos influenced, emotional, super lyric based.
First song you wrote.
It was called Jasmine Tea.
Okay.
And
do you remember any of the lyrics?
Yeah, but I'm not going to tell you them.
Oh. Because you're saving them for a future song.
No. No, but real fans will remember. But yeah, you know, it was just lots of self-referential things about my own life that no one would understand. No, like, no audience awareness. No, like, awareness of, like, all right, here's how you take your own, you know, life and turn it into something that might be appreciated by someone else to relate to. Just pure, like, I'm going to write my own pain. But it was
my diary.
Yeah.
To read.
It was really cathartic to do that, and it gave me a thing to do. Because I dropped out of high school, and...
I did,
and, you know, I was lucky to not suffer more severe consequences. I went to Cuesta. I eventually finished that. I eventually went to Humboldt State, and I have two master's degrees, and I'm a third of the way done with PhD. So educationally, it worked out, but at the time, it wasn't the right...
But kids at home, we don't recommend it?
No, but I would say parents at home, if you have a precocious young child, figure out how to get them to where they need to be. Like, not everyone needs to go through the same rigmarole.
Oh, well, then let's talk about that then. How was this a decision you and your mom made together that high school wasn't working out, or how did you...
When I was 15, I tested out. I took the California High School Proficiency Exam, which I don't think is the thing anymore, but I'm sure they have something similar. But I couldn't leave until I was older, and she was really trying to get me to finish. And, you know, I don't know if I was mature enough to really start Cuesta then or college then, but it might have helped to just kind of cut to the chase, because mm-hmm. I just resisted anything mm-hmm. remotely like learning mm-hmm. for a couple of years.
Was it because of the atmosphere on campus not feeling welcome, or was it just, I mean, clearly you're a bright man. Was it that the school wasn't stimulating enough?
Maybe. I think, to be honest, I had some pretty severe chemical imbalances.
Okay.
And I think I was really depressed, but also kind of manic and, you know, very creative.
Like many artists are.
Yeah, maybe I was ADHD. I don't know. I couldn't focus on mm-hmm. school. I couldn't do math. I didn't even really like reading. I mean, I'm a librarian by day. That's my, like, what I do. And I'm a writer and teach writing. So books are important to me now. But I couldn't focus on anything. But music was the one thing I really could focus deeply on, mm-hmm. to the point where, you know, listening to records and writing songs and practicing with a band and playing and stuff. That's all stuff that takes a lot of focus.
Yeah, it does.
And I was really into booking shows and, like, booking events and things. I loved
for yourself or for other people as well?
For me and friends. I mean, we would just put on shows at places, mm-hmm. and it would be five bands, you know, and or at a party. I loved to make the flyers. So anything around the music industry, I was super into.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that gave me a focus. It still does. I mean, that's still, art is still the way I get through my life. Mm-hmm. It's like how it makes sense to me.
Do you still do the graphic drawing arts as well, or mostly?
Not so much. I'm pretty much tapped out with, like, between writing music and all the business around music. But I think it'd be interesting to go there someday. Yeah. I loved going to the art store when I was really little. That was, like, a thing for me.
So when you tested out and you were done at 15, by that time you'd already written some songs. Mm-hmm. Was the goal, hey, I'm going to make my money, Mom, on the road. I know I've got this. Or was that still a hobby energy thing? What were you thinking?
I was never a hobby person with that.
Okay.
It used to bother me when people would call it a hobby. A lot.
I'm sorry that
you... No, not now. I don't have the same baggage, but, like...
But you took it seriously, basically.
I took it really seriously, yeah. And that's what I wanted. And I did that as much as I possibly could until I was about 30.
Wow.
I was in a lot of bands. I did, you know, went to school to go to school. And I did some other stuff, too, but my main interest was music, and that's what I did. And I lucked out. Like, I had some bands that did well, or I was in some bands that did okay and got to tour.
A couple bands that you've been in.
The biggest one was called Port O'Brien, and everyone was from here, but we were based in Oakland. And that band had some really good luck initially and kind of blew up in, like, 2005, 6, 7-ish. And we went on tour in the U.S. and around the world and put out records and things. So that was my first, you know, big foray into music. And from around then till, like, maybe 2012 or so, I was really in it and, like, trying. And it's really hard, though, because it's really hard to make money. And so what you find is a lot of people who might not need to make as much money mm-hmm. are able to stay in. And people who don't have any, it's really tough just to keep it going. Mm-hmm. You have to find a way to do it. And then eventually, for me, it was just like, I remember I hit 29, 30 and thought, I need to take a break from this. I am so poor. Mm-hmm. I just switched gears. I stopped. It was great to stop, too. It was a really good decision.
Were you doing your master's work then as well?
It's when I started the master's in library science, my first one. So I just decided I'm going to throw myself into this because, you know, it was 29 or 30. I had never made money. I'd never had a salaried job because I was very dedicated to music. And the myth about music, like, you know, people will say things like, get a job or whatever. The hardest job in the world, well, I'm not going to say that. The hardest job in the world is, like, digging a ditch or doing any kind of manual labor. But one of the harder jobs is being an artist and going to the shows and loading the gear and going on tour with no money and doing it day in, day out, all the time. It is rough. So by that time, I just needed a break. And mm-hmm. wow, healthiest thing I ever did for myself was to just let it go. And I took about 10 years off.
Wow, bigger than a break. That's like a detour.
Well, I felt like I needed to get a profession and get a job, and I did. Took about 3 years to do that. And then I got married in that time, and we moved around a bit for work, and then ended up back here eventually. And, you know, I had established myself as a person who can do a job and can make a, like, income. And
did it make you feel more grown up?
Yeah, but it killed my soul.
Yeah.
Like, creatively.
Yeah.
It was
tough.
Were
you still writing at all during the time? Yeah.
What I did was I kept going writing-wise and recording, too, sometimes. And I would just self-release stuff just for my own edification. But nothing really serious, and I didn't try to, like, really do anything, you know. I kind of gave up. I think though I let go of that to the healthiest degree I could, but I kept writing. And that was really good because it kept me in that world enough to when I was ready, and I'll say that, you know, that's just a year or so ago, things started happening again. And I put myself in a position where I was able to do some stuff and I've had some luck recently and signed a record deal with a really great label.
Congratulations.
And I'm back in the saddle very much. And that's crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really let go of this ambition and I thought I was done. And I also kind of pivoted to writing poetry and getting into that world. I did a second master's in English Lit and that really like woke this part of my brain up that had been kind of asleep. And I was like, oh, literature, here we go. And that world is really important to me and equally where I am right now. I'm doing a PhD in creative writing, and all of that's really, really great. But then the music thing just kind of came back.
It's almost like you let it go and it was allowed to just naturally occur. Like maybe were you holding on too tight?
I think there's something to that. Like you need to push, but you can push too hard and make things not happen. It's kind of like when you're early in a relationship and it's happening. If you go too hard, that person's going to get a little spooked.
Yes.
Maybe. Which
yeah, so true.
Has always been
I've
my thing.
I've done a few of those.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, maybe there's something to that. Maybe it's the right time for me. I certainly have a better toolkit to handle the stress of being a musician and an artist and the uncertainty of being a creative person. So when I was younger, in my 20s, doing the thing, touring and stuff, it was very challenging for me financially, but it was also really challenging mental health-wise.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Caleb Nichols. He's a musician, a poet, a songwriter, a librarian, and we met backstage at Live Oak Music Festival and talked about every aspect of his life, and he was so forthcoming as well about his own issues around mental health and anxiety and having to overcome a lot of fears in order to successfully find his way into all of the interests that he has. We'll continue our conversation with Caleb Nichols. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. You touched on feeling like you had struggles with depression or anxiety undiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
How did that manifest itself?
It manifested itself in a classic way, which is I started having panic attacks and not knowing what they were, and also no access to healthcare,
right,
or a therapist or anything. So when I was in college, and I was in this band, Port O'Brien, and I was going to Humboldt State, which is like a 5 hours from Oakland to Humboldt. So I was driving up and down a lot. It was very, woo, I was really like off the rails, just doing my thing. And you know, I was self-medicating a lot, just drinking a lot. I discovered Ativan, and in some ways actually lucky because it kind of helped me get through some things. But one of the things, so I was having these panic attacks, but it was also, I had never flown on an airplane. And I discovered at this around this time that that was the worst thing I could possibly do. It was the most terrifying thing, and I had no way to deal with it. I had no idea why. I didn't understand. I mean, it was a physiological response, like
right.
a dog taking a bath. Like
right.
I remember the first time I went with the band somewhere, I tried to get off the plane before we left. And my bandmates were like, sit down.
Yeah.
And I was like, you don't understand where this whole thing's going down. Like, because, you know, you project like this premonition.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole, I had a big mental health crisis, which was unresolved.
And how old were you?
24. And I just dealt with it the best way I could, but I didn't really deal with it till I was about 30 or so.
So you patchworked together your mental health for 10 years.
Yeah, which really, really made being a musician difficult because it's an uncertain place to be. So if you don't have that certainty, it can be hard to operate if you have these issues.
Right. Because you always need to feel somewhat safe or need an escape hatch.
Yes.
And when you need to show up at 8 o'clock for a gig, you don't have an escape hatch, right, which triggers the attacks.
Especially if the gig is in, like, London.
Yeah, and you've got to fly on a plane to get there.
Exactly. Yeah. Or you find yourself, I'm in a different country, and I'm all of a sudden really freaked out.
Yeah. And you can't exactly just get on a plane and go home.
Yeah, and also the other thing is back then, I don't think people were as understanding as they are right now. I think there's a lot of talk about this, which is great. But, you know, people would be like, oh, well, you're going crazy. So we need to find a new bass player.
Yeah, that's helpful.
And so you need to hide it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you definitely need... I needed to hide these things to the best of my ability.
Go into the closet with your mental health, please.
Very much. But what I did was I turned it into a joke.
Okay.
So, and that's how I got through a lot of school and stuff. If I was able to make fun of myself enough, then it was like, oh, Caleb's so crazy. And here's, and let me tell you a great story about the time that I, you know, was in Alaska but couldn't fly home. So I took a boat, but then the boat scared me. So then I bought a car, and then the car scared me. My brother had to come rescue me. And I could tell you this whole story, right? That's really entertaining.
Is this a true story?
That is. But that's the habit I got into, was turning that absolutely horrible experience,
yeah,
actually
terrifying,
into
trauma,
something that's really, really funny.
Yeah. And trains and automobiles, it could be a movie.
I mean, and there is humor in it also,
but I hear what you're saying. It's, there was no outlet, there was no sign saying come this way and you'll be okay,
right?
So you're just spinning.
Yes. And really, I mean, some in those kinds of instances, really spinning, mm-hmm, and really not, you know, almost not making it. So, you know, in some ways, quitting music and letting go of it was just a protection. I mean, I couldn't do it anymore. But now, you know, I went to therapy for years. I spent my 30s doing that and still do it when I need to. The pandemic really made me have to go back. I found a great therapist, and she really helped me when I started feeling these feelings again. Just going, you know, to Paso Robles or something from SLO. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I developed kind of almost like agoraphobia.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And, but therapy saved me. Absolutely. And now I can do all kinds of things. So it's kind of nice. But I couldn't have, you know, if you had handed me a record deal and some tour dates when I was, you know, even 33, I probably would have not been able to do that.
Interesting. Library sciences, you know, talk about just like,
yeah,
putting yourself in a cocoon,
totally,
of safety.
Yes.
Like, I get up, I go to my place, I know where my books belong.
Exactly.
Everything is in order.
It's very like that. And you know, paradoxically, I love the library and I love books and things, but I also really bristle against that kind of sedentary, controlled lifestyle. And it's always been a paradox for me. Like, I'm too afraid to go out into the world, but I also
don't want to be
exactly.
I know. Well, interesting also, because you have such fond memories of your mom and you in the library, that makes so much sense that you would feel that was a safe space.
Yeah. You know, the thing that got me into libraries was I had always worked, you know, part-time in bookstores and record stores. So I thought, how could I do that but, like, you know, level up the salary?
Yeah.
And I really went in that blind to what library science, librarianship was. And now I know what it is. More. I've been in the field for 8 years. But, and it's not that exactly, but it is actually kind of not that far off.
So if you were to meet someone, hello, nice to meet you, Caleb Nichols. Mm-hmm. How do you introduce yourself then?
Yeah, I do wear a lot of hats. Mm-hmm. It depends on the context.
Okay, hi. Nice to meet you, Caleb Nichols. What's your life about?
Oh, I'm a musician because we're at a music festival.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
Okay. But maybe, if I meet you downtown?
Maybe I'm a poet too when I'm a musician. Those things are the same for me. Very close.
Okay.
No, I think in general, I think of myself as an artist first, and I do some things to make a living, and yeah, I think teaching is a close second. Also, that's very much informs my writing, especially. So,
where do you teach?
I teach one section of English 134 at Cal Poly.
Do you really?
Yeah, at least.
Then we are colleagues.
Sometimes. Oh, are we really?
Yes, because I teach in the psych and CD department.
Oh, sweet. I'm also the course reserves guy at the library.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
We've probably interacted there, too.
I'm trying to remember if your name's been on a book. But, yeah.
With the black mark. She doesn't know what she's doing.
What is this?
Yeah. So, let's talk about the music piece, then.
Yeah.
What, you started off with the Beatles influence.
Mm-hmm.
Where has that taken you now? What inspires you?
Well,
what kind of music are you writing these days?
The new record
yes.
is, it's all about the Beatles, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's a rock opera called Ramon that tries to tell the story of Mean Mr. Mustard.
Okay.
And so the question is, why is he so mean? Who is this person? I just had this idea a long time ago, actually. What is this person all about? It's such a weird character. Sleeps in the park, shaves in the dark, etc. Screams at people, all that stuff. So, and it's a minute long, you know. It's a really short little ditty that John Lennon called a bit of crap that he wrote in India. He wasn't thrilled with it. But I've always been intrigued by that song. And I wanted to sort of write the story of this character, the backstory. So I started doing that just musically, and I just had this idea not to do a tribute album or something like that, but just how can I make an indie rock album that explores this and uses some Beatles kind of like pastiches and like musical ideas to kind of tell the story. And so, you know, it's Beatles-y, so it should be kind of quirky and a little weird, but also a little sad,
mm-hmm.
And a little joyful. And so, yeah, I kind of spent a year or so writing this story. And then I went and recorded it with a bunch of friends, and that is this record.
When you started this project, Ramon, did you have the record deal already?
No.
So this was just independent of the deal and more just an outlet of something for you.
It was, and that's kind of crucial because, you know, oftentimes I write, like I was saying, when I was a teenager, I write about my life, I write about myself, etc. This was one of the first times I really wrote outside of that musically and wrote about something completely outside of me. Now, of course, my life gets in there, but, you know, I really had a mission to write this story about this character. So it was very creative.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so biographical, memoir-y. And this is the record that got me signed to Kill Rock Stars. So it worked, I guess.
Did you shop it?
I sent some stuff around during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Right before the pandemic, we had decided, my husband and I had a band called Soft People.
Okay.
And we had decided we were going to try to give it a go, like a real go. Because we met in a band and like that band was really serious. And then, you know, we hadn't really worked together since then. And that had been about 10 years. And we just decided, let's try to do this. Let's spend, instead of going on vacation a bunch, let's spend some time working together and go on tour and stuff. So we made an album, and then the pandemic happened. We made the album, we had this plan, and we had planned on pressing the record to vinyl, and then the pandemic happened. So we had all this vinyl. It was like a short run, so it was like 150 copies of this other record, totally different record.
Okay.
Meanwhile, my rock opera's just been done for a while. It's just sitting there. So I sent the vinyl out to a few people, and I had had a run-in with the label before, maybe 10 years before. It didn't work out. But I knew them, so I was able to send them this other record.
Right.
And sending it to them on vinyl really helped pique their interest. And that got the founder, this fellow named Slim Moon, who's kind of fairly legendary indie rock person. It made him kind of pause and listen. And he didn't really like the record we made.
Okay.
I mean, I think he liked it, but it wasn't what he was looking for. Right. But then through that, he discovered other stuff, and it led to him signing this project for this reason. And signing me as a solo artist rather than in this band. So.
But what about your husband?
You know,
out?
No, he's around. I mean, he sometimes plays bass in the band. But, you know, we have a life here and we have pets and it's hard to just uproot and go. So he's also a lot more home-oriented than I am, or he's more comfortable with that. So he likes to hang out at home.
Which, again, is ironic.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
You're the one who grapples with the being out in the world.
Yes.
And he's happy nesting.
Very happy nesting.
And so, you've got the ants.
I do, and I like both nowadays. I'm happy being, you know, in our place. We have a nice place. I have a little garden and all these things. But I also still, like, desire to be out in the world doing things. It's really hard, though, because now it's almost flipped to where I have the opportunities and I have a very full schedule for the next year of traveling. And I'm like, well, I don't really want to go.
But when you weren't and had no options, you're like, wait, I just want to get out.
Ramon, give your heart to somebody soon before you fade away.
cards to somebody who won't cause you pain. Crawl through that window.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to music from Caleb Nichols' recent release called Ramon. Caleb and I met backstage at Live Oak Music Festival and talked about his life growing up here in San Luis Obispo County, his journey from punk rock musician to two master's degrees, and working to finishing his PhD in creative and critical writing, and also maintaining his marriage and relationships. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. How did marriage change your life, and how did you meet?
Well, we met in the band. Okay. He was the drummer. Mm-hmm. We dated for 3.5 years before we got engaged, and then we got engaged, and we got married maybe 4 years in. And, you know, marriage has changed my life for the better very much. You know, they talk about having a better half, and I definitely have that in my husband. And it's given me, he is like, you know, the classic spouse who is really like the actual thing. You know, I like run around doing all my creative stuff, but I couldn't do it without him. So that's pretty true. He's a rock, very much. He's a Taurus, you know.
He's steady.
Super earthy, yeah. He's very steady. He's a really good skateboarder, too.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very talented.
Did he grow up here as well?
He did, yeah.
But you didn't...
We didn't meet until I lived in Oakland, and he was going to UC Santa Cruz.
Oh, that's interesting, okay.
Yeah, so it was later. It was much later.
And how about your mom?
She lives in Cayucas with her husband, and she's doing great.
Still an instrumental part of your life?
Yeah, we get lunch pretty much once a week. That's our thing.
And so where do you, you know, I know you probably don't want to project like here I'm going to be, but where are you moving towards?
Well, I'm literally moving to Wales.
Oh, like a physical move. Are you swimming there, boating?
Yeah,
how are you getting there?
I'm flying. Okay. I can do that now.
Okay.
I'm in a PhD program that's based there, so I'm going to go do the second year of that there. Starting in October, and then right before we'll do some shows out in the UK. So I see myself moving towards embracing the artist life a little more whenever possible. It's really tough though, I will tell you. It's not like an easy thing. I still struggle. Well, I still struggle with fear and anxiety and sometimes panic, but thankfully not lately. But it is an existential struggle because I worry about my life, of course, like anybody. So when I'm out and about, or actually when I'm out and about, I'm fine.
Yep.
But when I'm building up to going, you know, out for 9 months is what I'm about to do. That's a lot.
The anticipatory anxiety is what drives us.
Absolutely.
Right? That's...
And it's the anticipatory anxiety of not doing anything that drives me as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, I tend to like fill my plate.
Well, people always seem to be surprised because anxiety is my friend. Like, everyone has a neurosis, right? Everyone carries something, and so anxiety is my friend. And it's interesting, my first day of grad school, where I was hoping no one would look over and notice that I probably shouldn't be there, and I don't know if everyone who goes to grad school feels that way.
I think so.
Yeah, but so I was hoping to God no one would notice that I was an imposter.
Yes.
And the first professor came out, and he said, "You all have neurosis of some kind. No one goes into this work because they're fine. And no one is fine."
Yeah.
And he said, "And if I had to choose my neurosis, I would want to have anxiety be my neurosis because anxious people are the most alive people on the planet. They experience everything without a filter. And so you feel every emotion." He said, "Of course, we understand the downside, but anxiety is the greatest gift." And no one had ever said anything like that. I struggled with it from the time I was 12,
yeah.
And now I was 30 when I went to grad school, and no one had ever couched it that way. And all of a sudden I went, "Oh, okay, I think I'm fine." It was a monumental moment. And then looking around at everyone else, realizing, I wonder what their thing is, and I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
Just that simple statement
yeah.
of reframe changed my life.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I never feel anxious.
Of course.
Or depressed, or panicky, but
yeah.
I know it's not going to kill me, and that was foundational.
Well, and I think, you know, for me, the takeaway there is how a couple of words did that to you. And I think that's why I'm so drawn to language, and music is part of that. It's so powerful. It can do, it literally runs the world. There, I can't remember which dead famous white poet said this, but maybe it's Byron or Shelley, I think it's Shelley.
Okay.
He said that poets are the unseen legislators of the world. And I think about that, you know, when Joe Biden took office, he read a bunch of Seamus Heaney, sorry. And
I don't even know. I wouldn't have known if you got it wrong.
He's an Irish poet. And you think about how these words are used. They're powerful. Mm-hmm. They start and stop wars. Mm-hmm. They start and stop our, you know, mental health issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk therapy is a really potent thing when you do it. So I'm just so attracted to that. And so when I get anxious, I try to remind myself I'm on this really cool trajectory. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's all about just showing up and doing the plan. Just do the plan, because I always want to get out of the plan, even if I've made the plan.
Right. So, well, because you like the business, like you. That
I do
would...
like the business. It consumes me, but I gotta like make room for creativity. You can't have too much business, or you stop writing poems, or you stop writing music. So, it's a weird balancing act, gotta say. You know, I don't want to like jinx myself, and I'm knocking on this wooden stool. This year has been the least anxious year of my life, in a way. Because I've had some high anxiety, but I've done so much that I'm learning that I can do it. So, like, one thing I did that really helped me is I went and played South by Southwest. And
wow.
The only thing that I could do schedule-wise was go play and come back, like, 24 hours. So I went to L.A., I got on a plane, I flew to Texas, I met up with my band, I did one rehearsal. I went to a club, I played at 12 in the morning, 12 a.m. I played for an hour, I went to the hotel, and I flew home the next day. And leading up to that, I was like, I don't think I can do this, because I could never have seen myself doing something that crazy.
Right.
And I think even a lot of non-anxious people would be like, what are you doing?
Yeah, exactly.
That's like a crazy trip. But I did it. Mm-hmm. Cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was able to do it, and so, like, that was just like, I was like, well, if I can do that, I can pretty much do whatever. So, you know, booking shows in the UK or booking shows in New York and flying out to them, things like that. I never could do that before. Mm-hmm. And now I can. And that's just changed my life quite a lot.
Yeah, I think it's confidence and growth. And you have to keep going. Because the day you cancel a trip, you'll curl up in a ball on your floor.
That's exactly right. Totally. I've done that.
Oh,
you
okay.
know, so I know that. And like, there's nothing you can do about it other than it's all. I don't subscribe to tough love, but that kind of is the medicine sometimes, is holding someone in place.
Yes.
Lovingly.
Yes.
To help them get through it.
Yes.
Because you know if you let them collapse, they'll stay collapsed. Yes. For a long time. So yeah, that's really true. That's what I'm trying to remind myself all the time these days. It's like, there's going to be when I flew to Texas, I mean, I have a physiological fear response to flying to heights. And I, you know, went through this therapeutic process where I realized, well, I've had this fear of heights since I was 4 or 3. I mean, my life. It's a physiological thing.
Right.
That developed into a psychological problem. Like,
became a phobia, yeah.
It became a phobia. And my altimeter in my brain is a little more sensitive than other people's. When I go up high, heart starts racing, palms start sweating. Even if I want to be up high.
Right.
And so I've had to learn to cope with that first response and then, like, move on. But so I'm on the plane to Texas and, like, yeah, take off. 30 minutes of just intense fear. Mm-hmm. That I couldn't do anything about.
Right.
You could take drugs, but I try not to. And not because I'm a hero, just because I don't want to ruin my experience. And I want to get myself used to it, kind of. You know, I don't know if I'm ever going to be used to it. I know when I get on the plane, it may be that way. But the trip home is always easier.
Yeah, I totally agree, because you're getting there. It's a matter of having lived long enough
yes.
that it hasn't killed me yet.
Right.
And so I just live with it.
Yeah.
And I think we need to retell the story of anxiety
yeah.
because we try to hide from it or
yes.
eradicate it or think it's going to go away. It's like, no, you
well,
have to befriend it.
It's funny because I was talking earlier about, you know, how I needed to turn my anxiety struggles into stories that were funny.
Yes.
But actually, and I think that was sort of problematic, but that is also helpful. And so, like, one thing that has that helped me, I wrote this very short book that's coming out in August. Late August on this publisher called Broken Sleep, which is in the UK. They're great, great press. And it's called Don't Panic. It used to be called Don't Panic, A Hitchhiker's Guide to Panic and Anxiety, but I don't think we could use Hitchhiker's Guide
too close legally.
Too close. But you know, a lot of it are my own stories, and I think probably the Alaska stories in there, who knows, I can't remember, I haven't looked at the manuscript in a while, but the point of this is writing those down and having this idea to share those with other people, because I meet a lot of people who don't know what's happening and they're having panic attacks or they're having anxiety, and I think post-COVID, a lot of people and a lot of people's family members. Mm-hmm. My husband has been so good at dealing, but he's had to learn. I mean, he's had to learn. He's had to watch me go through this, and sometimes he doesn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Now he pretty much knows. But at first, you know, like, he didn't know what he was walking into. I didn't know what he was walking into. So I thought it'd be good when I started having these things, you know, I mentioned not knowing what they were, not having access to anybody to tell me. Well, I thought it'd be good. What would I have wanted? And I was like, I remember I went to the bookshop in Santa Cruz where we were living at the time, and I found some books that kind of helped, you know, but nothing quite right. I just wanted a book to explain, like, really briefly what this was, mm-hmm. and then, like, tell me some stuff about it, and maybe something I could pick up and touch when I was having one. Mm-hmm. And that's what I tried to write, and I feel like that process of just writing the book helped me quite a lot, because putting it on paper externally, it was like, this is a story. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. I've written the story now, but the thing that's happening to me is also a story. So, yeah, words, man.
I know. How much it gets to own us is Don Us.
Yeah.
Caleb Nichols, thank you so much for giving me more time than you expected, but I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Love talking to you as well.
So the new album coming out is?
It's called Ramon. It's on Kill Rock Stars.
The book?
Is called Don't Panic on Broken Sleep.
All right, Caleb Nichols, thank you so much. Enjoy your experience here at Live Oak.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with singer, songwriter, author, musician, librarian, PhD candidate, Caleb Nichols, backstage at Live Oak Music Festival. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And as we wrap up our conversation at Live Oak with Caleb, I didn't want to stop my introduction of Caleb to you there, because he's just released a book, Don't Panic, A Hitchhiker's Guide to Panicking, with a series of essays describing his experience with mental health concerns throughout his life. And his description of panic is so relatable. It really caught me right away, because I could understand what he was describing from my own experiences and working with clients. And because anxiety disorder is the most common mental health concern that people have, I really wanted to share with you this essay. Once we hear that someone else has an experience that's similar to ours, knowing that we're not alone with our discomfort or the things that we're concerned about, that can really help to reduce levels of anxiety symptoms that we experience. So here's Caleb Nichols reading chapter 8 from his book, Don't Panic, A Hitchhiker's Guide to Panicking. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
This is chapter 8, Negative Capability. Let me tell you a story. The first time I landed in the emergency room due to panic and anxiety was back in 2012. In hindsight, I'm surprised I made it as long as I did without a visit, although this was when I was approaching 30, and to be sure, even I, chronic anxiety and panic haver, was blessed with a sense of invincibility in my 20s. I mean, as long as I wasn't in an airplane, on a bridge, in a building over two stories tall, riding a train, or in the near vicinity of a major metropolitan area. In my 20s, I didn't think about my health and was certain I would die in one of the above scenarios, that something big and bad was headed my way, but perhaps I could outrun it or avoid it. As I inched towards 30, all of that began to shift. I became hyper aware of my body and began to worry excessively about my heart, but also my head, my brain. I thought of all the ways I might die suddenly, a stroke, a giant undiscovered tumor, a pulmonary embolism. Of course, this was all possible, but equally true, worrying about it only does so much good. I knew that I could live a healthy lifestyle, and honestly, I pretty much did, save for the odd bender. My worry had a limit, and I blew through that, my reptile brain deciding that it needed to maintain vigilance 24 hours a day. I was at band practice at a studio in Oakland, a safe place for me, usually. I went there frequently, but something felt off that day. Even when I left our apartment in Santa Cruz, I remember thinking that I wanted to wear a nice pair of socks in case something happened. A lyric from a Sunset Rubdown song ghosted through my mind as I got ready. I hope that you die in a decent pair of shoes. You've got a lot of long walking to do. Where are you going to? My subconscious, so complicit in my misery. As band practice went on, my heart rate went up. Makes sense. When I sing, I really belt it out. And I play guitar pretty aggressively too. Mine was a loud, grungy indie band. I always broke a sweat. And when we played live, I would be positively dripping by the end. So what was different this time? Something, I decided. I knew that there was something wrong. It was a gut feeling. I told the guys I was feeling off and that I wanted to go to the doctor. They knew me. They looked concerned, but they were supportive, which is the correct way to handle this. I left determined to see a doctor safely back in Santa Cruz just to make sure. I stopped at the Rite Aid at 51st and Telegraph, a few blocks from where I used to live in the Temescal neighborhood, another place that felt safe and familiar. I decided I'd get some aspirin and water just in case. You know, in case I was having a very small and painless heart attack or was about to have one, the only symptom of which was a quick heartbeat after doing some strenuous exercise. I don't make the rules, as they say, I just obey the panic. I'm in Rite Aid, I've got my aspirin and water, then it hits, that insane rush that any panic sufferer knows, and what is often described officially as an overwhelming sense of doom. That's an understatement. It comes screaming in at Mach 5, a Blue Angel during Fleet Week. I can feel the sonic boom of the adrenaline rushing in to meet this unholy threat to save the day. This is all happening inside of me, standing in line at Rite Aid. I'm really good at hiding the fact that I'm having a panic attack, experiencing anxiety, or that I'm just really unhappy when I'm in public, but my practice defenses were no match for this. I turned a shade of sickly gray, started doing a weird dance I often do when I panic, and then thinking, this is it, the heart attack, I opened the aspirin bottle, which naturally exploded all over the floor, scooped two up, pounded them down with water, steadily drawing a small crowd of onlookers from a safe distance. This was Telegraph Avenue in Oakland, after all. People did far stranger things on the quarter hour. And at the peak of my freakout, a voice called to me across an unnavigable expanse. Next, please. I made eye contact with the cashier. He did not seem to notice that I was about to die. How strange. But then we could never really know, truly know anyone, can we? I put the bottle of water and the empty bottle of aspirin on the counter. I croaked out, can you please call an ambulance? And he was like, what? I repeated myself. He said, are you sure? I screamed at him, I'm having a heart attack, call an ambulance. That did the trick. He called 911. I talked to a dispatcher. She sighed knowingly. People who are having heart attacks usually aren't as riled up as I was, but sent some paramedics anyway. And 30 minutes later, what a long heart attack I was having. A couple of very nice EMTs showed up, did an EKG, said there might be something funny with it, but that I was definitely wasn't having any issues at the moment. And I could choose whether or not to go to the ER or make an appointment with my own doctor later. I still thought I was dying, so opted for the ER. I just could not fathom that what had happened to me was just in my head, as so many of us experience when we have our first big one. I texted something extremely dramatic to my husband, who was only my boyfriend at the time and stupidly young, a farewell perhaps, like, tell my mother I'll miss her, don't forget to feed the cat, but maybe even a last will and testament. At the Highland Hospital ER, I was deposited on a gurney into a little closet-like room. I waited for an hour, 2 hours, longer. Of course, I was still alive, which felt oddly anticlimactic. I was really tired, because a giant dose of adrenaline will do that to you. But other than that, I was just bored. Someone came and did another EKG, and then I waited for another few hours. People with all sorts of emergencies were wheeled by. I saw a guy who had been shot. They had bigger fish to fry. That's when the doctor appeared finally to discuss my results. We'll call him Dan, but I have no idea what his name was, only that his name badge clearly read intern. They had no health insurance and did not actually care who he was, only a wish that he'd break the news of my pending demise gently. "Your EKG was fine," he said robotically. "Totally normal. There's nothing wrong with you, or at least with your heart." I braced myself. What had they discovered? The tumor? "Have you done something recently that you feel guilty about?" he asked. I thought about this for a moment. No, I had not. Other than being vaguely ashamed of my sexuality and body, worried about my overconsumption of gasoline on my weekly trips to Oakland, and my chronic lack of money. But I wouldn't say guilty. I said as much. "I think you've just had a panic attack," he said. "They usually happen when someone feels guilty about something. You should see someone about getting medication, but for now, we'll send you home with some Ativan in case it happens again." "Hello, Ativan, my old friend." I was numb at this point, and my boredom, cultivated from sitting in a dark room by myself with no phone, book, or stimuli of any sort for 9 hours, had blossomed into the only rational emotional response available. "Just let me drive home now." And I did, along with my jug of drugs. The point of the story, aside from its sheer comedic value, is twofold. First, I wanted to share the story to firmly illustrate how panic, especially to the novice, can feel like being hit by a train. If you know, you know, as they say. Second, the attending ER intern said the dumbest I've ever heard anyone say about panic and anxiety ever in a long history of living with this, reading about it and talking to others about it and all the rest. Was I feeling guilty about something? Seriously. For the uninitiated, this is a good example of what not to say to someone who has just gone through an episode. Because first, what? But second, because there is no single determinant of what causes a panic episode to occur, and it certainly isn't the fault of the person suffering one. In fact, as far as I can tell, the jury is still out on what is happening in our brains and bodies. There are theories, sure, but that's it. But here's the hard truth. Nothing causes panic episodes, or I should say no thing. Or I should say there isn't always a discernible trigger. They sometimes just happen for no discernible reason at all. It's a terrible thought, but it's made it so much simpler. There doesn't need to be a reason. I just panic sometimes. Seriously, it's liberating. That panic just happens means that I'm not dying. True, it means it could happen again, and to be completely honest, it likely will. But when it does come, I know that's just a feeling for now, a very powerful one, like jealousy. But for example, it can feel all-consuming sometimes, and sometimes it can feel like the nothing of a breeze through an open window, but it will pass. The work becomes learning to accept uncertainty, which brings us to the larger point. The British romantic poet John Keats famously wrote about the concept of negative capability in a now famous letter to his brothers. Of course, Keats is talking about literature, especially poetry, but the idea is applicable to all sorts of endeavors, and particularly to the art of living with panic and anxiety, I think. It's hard medicine, friends, but there is no cure. However, like Keats, we can develop our ability to be in life's uncertainties, mysteries, doubts without, and this is the crucial piece for us, any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Once we accept that panic and anxiety are inevitable conditions or features of life, for everyone, I think, to varying degrees, but perhaps especially to us, the chosen ones, and that panic episodes come and go without always having discernible reasons, then we have come a long way towards freedom from their tyranny. Yes, true enough, we will never be truly free, but for my money, there is serious liberatory potential in freeing oneself from the fetters of cause and effect, at least when it comes to panic and anxiety. These days, when I have a panic episode, I still let it burn out, but I don't spend much time investigating the cause of the blaze. I might feel a bit curious about how that fire started, but instead of worrying about it too much, I very consciously focus my attention on helping it along. Usually I do some polyvagal breathing and distract myself with some tedious chore, the dishes, folding some clothes, data entry, the more rote and monotonous, the better. Or sometimes when the feeling is very physical, as it was this morning, I will take some ibuprofen and just dance it out. And you know what? It works. I'm still alive writing these words.
You've been listening to a reading by Caleb Nichols of his recent release, Don't Panic, A Hitchhiker's Guide to Panicking. This is a series of essays about his experience with mental health issues and concerns. And I think he does a fabulous job of describing what panic feels like and how it can overwhelm our entire life and experience. I want to take a moment to thank Caleb for being so open and so honest and willing to share his life and his stories. And Caleb is finishing up his PhD in creative and critical writing at Bangor University in Wales. And then I'm sure he'll be back in the States touring and sharing his wonderful music. Most recently is a rock opera that explores the backstory of the Beatles character Mean Mr. Mustard called Ramon. So if you're interested, check it out wherever it is you find your music. You can join our conversation by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook. You can leave messages there, find out about upcoming shows, see the people that we've been interviewing. You can podcast our show by visiting wherever it is you get your podcasts, search A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe, write a review, more people can follow the show, and it'll be uploaded at your convenience. And then you can also listen to years of previous shows by visiting kcbx.org and looking under the News Talk tab. As always, I appreciate you being part of the conversation, part of the community, listening and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Ramon, give your heart to somebody soon before you fade away. Show your cards to somebody who won't cause you pain. Crawl through that window. You can let your silver spoon lift all the weight off of your shoulders. And don't forget, I loved you. Yesterday.